I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. When Eric Schmidt, the chief executive officer of Google Inc., started chatting with investment bankers about taking Google public, one report said his own employees were jokingly referring to the meetings as keeping Eric out of jail. That's because the financial bull-riding rodeo days of the 1990s triggered scores of new regulations designed to restrain brokers and executives and investors. It's true, it's no longer easy to say, hey, I've got a good idea, and by doing so, attract a stampede of venture capitalists and bankers. Ordinary people who were once seduced into the high-tech speculation of the 1990s are still sitting at home, still nursing those burned fingers. So here's the question for all of us today. If Google, that people-friendly internet search engine powerhouse, decides to go public, if Google announces an initial public offering or IPO, would you buy a share in the company? Could Google's move into the public spotlight revive public interest in high-tech stocks? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me today, two people who, unlike most of the rest of us, never took their eye off high-tech as a place to invest. Ed Roberts is a professor at the Sloan School of Management at MIT and chairman of its Entrepreneurship Center. Ed has been working with startups for 40 years as founder, advisor, and researcher. Amy Salzhauer is a founder and managing director of Ignition Ventures. It's a company that helps young tech ventures find the money to get started. They are both in the Boston studio with me. It's nice to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let me start just by hearing from both of you about the importance of Google. We're not going to spend the hour talking about either Google or IPO, but it's making a lot of news. It's in the general interest magazines, and we're talking about it on the radio. Is it a big deal, Amy, or not?
I think that it could be a depressant if Google does not successfully IPO or come to the market with an initial public offering. It might have a dampening impact on people who are technology entrepreneurs. On the other hand, if it has good operating numbers and it comes to the market, it's probably coming in at a buoyant time, I think it will hopefully do well for itself. I'm not sure that a Google IPO specifically will have such a dramatic impact on technology entrepreneurship as a whole.
What do you think, Ed?
I have a little bit of disagreement with Amy, because I think that if the Google IPO was a real blowout and dramatically jumped following the offering, that would cause a lot more upside lust on the part of potential investors.
And when you talk about potential investors, I began by talking about ordinary people who were brought into the market who wouldn't normally have been investors in the 1990s, because they're
right.
Still out, aren't they?
I don't know whether they are or they aren't. If you look at NASDAQ, NASDAQ index has gone up about 60% just since last March, and NASDAQ historically has been the marketplace for the common man. But not being a collector of those kinds of detailed data, I don't know who's still out of the market.
One of the things that I think is important for individual investors to think about is the classic advice from investment gurus to really understand what it is you're buying. And an initial public offering is the same way. I think in the late 90s and the beginning of 2000, people might buy something just because it was called an internet stock. Well, if I said I was going to sell you a house, you wouldn't buy the house without inspecting the house, understanding whether you were buying a mansion on the Cape or whether you were buying a condemned lot.
But that was the goofiness of the 1990s. Everybody was just looking to get in on anything without inspecting it,
right.
Weren't they?
Exactly. You know, people who would go to the supermarket and insist on choosing their bananas and making sure they were ripe were buying things without looking at the fundamentals. And anytime you're investing in the stock market, I think it's very important to remember that you're not really buying the market. You're buying a part of a company. And what you're hoping is that the management team of that company will manage it in a way that your investment will go up. Now, there are lots of other psychological factors in the market, as Ed was saying, and he's absolutely right. But basically, you really need to look at the basic fundamental figures, the potential of the company's market sector before you buy a stock.
Ed, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about Google and high tech and what's happening in that sector on the program today goes back to an article I was reading a couple of days ago. There's been quite an interest, I'm told, in nanotechnology. Mm-hmm. It's one of the hot areas to get into. And someone had noticed that there was a stock, I forget its name, I think it might have been Nanotech, which was jumping in price.
Right.
It has nothing to do with nanotechnology. It just happens to have nano in its stock name. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, are we going back to a little bit of the silliness of the 1990s?
Well, you know, we may and we may not. Last week, given the timing, or 2 weeks ago, a company that's a venture capital firm called Harris & Harris in New York, and Charlie Harris, the head of it, happens to be on our advisory board at MIT, went public. And this is an old line firm, but they went public. Their stock market ticker symbol is Tiny, T-I-N-Y, because they focus on nanotech investments. The stock came out, I think, at $8 a share, and it's presently trading at $11.50 a share in a matter of a few weeks, a big upside. And there's somebody that understands and is putting serious attention into nanotechnology. If I were, and I'm not saying that I am, if I were really going to pursue nanotech, I'd be much happier looking at the likes of a Harris & Harris that has strong professional staff, 10 years of examination of this industry and the technology, and I'd be more confident that they might know how to make the investment than for me to go put some money into nanotech, whether it's nano or not nano,
right,
or whatever it might be.
I want to use the expertise that you two have in sort of sketching in what we've not been paying attention to since 1999, since 2000, since the high-tech bubble burst and it slipped back onto the business pages from the front pages. Amy, it's your business, and you've got a company, Ignition Ventures, that's in the business of helping people right at the very early stage. This is way before a public offering, right?
Absolutely. We really are working with technologies and scientists that have discovered something in a laboratory, and we start the company. And one of the pieces of starting a company is getting the company funded.
This is seed money, is that what it's called at that early stage, or even before that?
It's generally called seed money, or people might call it a Series A, which is just saying that it's some of the first investor money that's coming into a company that's, especially a Series A, would be considered an institutional investor, like a venture capital firm.
Okay. Now, are those people with that money, are they putting it into people who are coming up with good ideas? Is this a part of a recovery of high tech that we're not paying attention to?
Well, it's very interesting. When we first started in 1999, it was very hard to get those kinds of companies started. We would walk in and a venture capital firm might say, well, we're looking for the company to IPO in 18 months.
Oh, so 99, this is before the burst,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
So we're talking about the silly times now.
The silly times, it was very difficult.
A jump from the seed money to going to a public offering in a year and a half?
And that, for the kind of deep technology companies that we focus on, we were hoping to have a prototype of the technology within 18 months. Now, as the bubble burst, investors started focusing again on the fundamentals and on what would really be created by a company. And things got a lot easier for us. So we could credibly come in and say, this is going to be a 4 or 5 year growth cycle, which was more like before the bubble, and mm-hmm. people are willing to invest in those companies. I think it actually, when the IPO market is considered to be down, it's easier for early stage companies to get money because it's a high risk, high reward. So it's more worth their while.
You get in really early and you're going to get the best return on that. Ed, I said at the beginning of the program that you've had 40 years experience here, and I want you to give us that telescope for this conversation. We, you know, are so short-sighted these days. We tend to talk about things that are happening in the market in a 5-year period or a 10-year period. When we look at the zoom and the boom in high tech in the 90s, the bust and the recovery that we're trying to make sense of now, can you fit it into a more natural, cyclical understanding of how the market works?
Yeah, precisely. The market works in cycles, and the cycles can be induced not necessarily because of the economy, so it's not necessarily an economic cycle, but you can have a lot of psychological factors that are affecting the cycle. I remember, to use my age as a base, One of the companies that I participated in starting in the Boston area is a company called Medical Information Technology, or Meditech. We started it in 1969. We got funded in August of 69 by EG&G, another old Boston firm, and we thought everything was fine. Well, if you looked at what was happening in the public market essentially died the next quarter. And for 2 years, there was essentially no more IPOs. There were, I think, three IPOs during a period of a year and a half. So if you were trying to get funded just a little bit after we got funded, and we were lucky, therefore, you would have run into great struggles. I have some disagreement with what Amy said about that it's easier for companies to get funded when the IPO market is low. It's easier for companies to get some money sometimes when companies are low. But I'll give you a counterexample. I'm in a group called Common Angels in Boston, and Common Angels are sophisticated, successful software entrepreneurs who invest individually in early-stage startup software companies.
That's what an angel is, isn't
That's
it?
What
Someone
an angel
who
is,
who comes
right.
in early, like Amy was describing.
And we invest right at the very beginning of these companies. Well, we went 18 months with no investments because we finally had gotten so burned by the internet bubble of which us wonderful, sophisticated investors were just as guilty as everybody else as being fools. We just backed away. We
Where
held
are
our
you
meetings.
Now? Where, what's happening right
now?
We've
come back. And we now are, we made our first new investment about 6 months ago. We've made two more investments since then. And we're now looking much more optimistically and positively. So psychologically, you need to get past the burnout stage on the downside of a cycle. And I think that that's a counter issue relating to ease of getting money.
Well, let me clarify, because I didn't mean it was necessarily easy to get money, but Series B rounds. So what Uh-oh. We were talking about exactly, a Series A, the first institutional money in, and then the company has grown. Maybe it has a little revenue. Maybe it doesn't hasn't made its first sales yet, but it needs
it's
more
ready
money
to put
to
a
expand.
Widget on the table and say, see what we built?
That's right.
Okay.
And in the last several years, there have been some companies, that quite a few actually, that had very solid numbers as a company, and yet they were having a very, very difficult time, probably because of this burnout, for one, raising money. A more difficult time, I felt, relatively compared to the value of their investment than we were raising these very, very early Series A rounds. And I think maybe the risk-reward factor was in there. Now I think that's starting to come around. Speaking to some of the big funds here, they see an uptick in corporate spending.
This is institutions putting money behind more risky ventures,
yes,
is when you talk about corporate spending?
Well, no, that's corporations actually buying technology.
Oh, okay.
So if you're a venture capital firm investing in a company, that company still actually needs to sell things to somebody to make money. And now, listening to the big funds, one of the billion-dollar funds said that in the fourth quarter, their companies, many of their companies, exceeded their revenue plans for the first time in 2 to 3 years.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, a conversation about what we know, about what's happening in high tech, and a chance to hear from you about whether or not this is the sort of investment that you are ready to reconsider some 2 years after the burst of the high tech bubble. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio this hour, Ed Roberts, professor at the Sloan Center of Management at MIT, chairman of MIT's Entrepreneurship Center. Amy Salzhauer is also with me. She's founder and managing director of Ignition Ventures. It's a company which looks to find ways of funding the technological, scientific, medical ideas at the very early stages. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Medford, Massachusetts. Jim's joining us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Good. Thank you for having a show on this topic.
So what do you think?
Well, being an investor that got heavily burned in the high-tech sector, I think that it's scary to think about investing in high tech right now, and the average investor doesn't have access to IPOs. So I'd like to hear a little commentary about what that impact has on the market.
Just a little bit about your own perspective, Jim. When you look back at what you did wrong, or you know, I mean, I know it's hindsight now, but what does that give you enough direction to say, aha, this is how I want to invest next time? Or you sort of look at it and go, man, it's just, you know, I did all the right things and I still lost money.
Well, you know, it depended, I think, too heavily on my broker's advice, which was probably a bad thing to do. And the second thing that I probably did wrong, which a lot of people did, was I was just too greedy. I thought the bubble would go on forever. And the general, you know, the general approach that people are told, individual investors are told, you know, hold on to stocks because if they're going down, they're only going to go up in value. Or hold on to mutual funds. And I got burned real bad.
All right, Jim, thanks for your call. I'm going to ask Ed Roberts on this one. I think Jim makes a really good point that when a small company goes after public money for the very first time, you know, the bank is the one that figures out who that money's going to come from. Institutional investors will buy a little bit. There's rarely, you know, much at the corner grocery store for you and me to go in and pick up. What's the link there between how we make sense of what's happening in initial public offerings, these so-called IPOs, and what it means for ordinary people who are thinking about putting money into something like high tech?
Well, when you say the bank, you mean the investment bankers.
I do, yeah.
And the investment bankers are, to put it in everybody's day-to-day terms, they are the Merrill Lynch, the Citigroup, Smith Barney's, the CSFB's, USB's,
yeah.
All of those big firms that are large brokerage firms, all of whom have very large retail syndicates across the country and the like. Now, they will allocate their offerings if they're oversubscribed. If that means if there's more people who want to buy the stock than they have stock to sell. They'll both try to jack up the price of the stock at the offering, and they'll get into an allocation mode. They obviously will allocate a lot of it to favorite clients, and I think the gentleman who called is right. If he's a small individual investor, he probably is going to have difficulties getting stock at the initial offering price. On the other hand, if he were enthusiastic about a particular offering, he could buy it a minute after the offering price because somebody is selling right away. Now, he might not want to pay the premium over the offering, although if it's really a wonderful stock, then maybe paying the premium over the offering doesn't matter if he wants to get in. I remember that I didn't buy Digital Equipment Company because I couldn't get into the offering, and it jumped on the day of offering, and I said, oh, God, that's it. It'll never go beyond that.
Don't tell me what happened.
Well, you know, Digital became a great corporation, and it was short-sighted foolishness on my part. But it's difficult to not sympathize with what Jim said. I had precisely the same experiences. I lost a lot of money because of foolishness. And I think that
encouraging for the rest of us to listen to.
Those of us who thought we were wise. You know, I thought I knew things. But given that all of these things were happening in internet companies and people around me said, Ed, you don't understand. And I would say, well, I guess I don't understand. The prior 30 years taught me wrong things for this new world. And I figured, okay, I have to adjust. So part of my adjustment was that I started jumping into things that totally were mismatches with what I thought was good sense. Real companies, these weren't real companies. Companies that had real products, they didn't have real products. Companies that had possibly revenues, wow, that would be great. Companies that had profits, wow, that would be fantastic. That's what I had believed. And when everybody said to me, no, you're old-fashioned, I said, you must be right, and proceeded to lose a lot of money over the period of the bubble. So I think that a lot of us have learned that. If you're very young and you didn't experience the bubble, then you can maybe have a chance to experience failure anew in the next round. If you're old enough to have gone through the bubble, I think that you'll be more cautious, and that's a good thing, being more cautious.
Let's hear from Vinay Bigat. He is founder and chairman of Convio in Austin, Texas. That's a company that creates software to help public sector organizations attract and motivate their constituents. And Vinay, I think you founded Convio, what, 4 years ago? Is that right?
Yes, I founded it in 1999 and first raised capital in November 1999.
Now, you have not taken your company public, right?
That is correct. We're still a privately held company.
Are you thinking of doing that?
Absolutely. Not at this current time, but we're certainly building the company on a trajectory to the point we'd like to take it public.
And when you put your own sort of wisdom thermometer in the market, what are you reading at this point? Is the right moment a few months away, a few years away? What do you think?
Well, I think the picture for us has changed in the last few months as we've seen two dynamics come into play. One is, I think, a resurgence of interest in technology companies, and I think imminent IPOs like Google and Salesforce.com have helped to contribute to that renewed optimism. Secondly, as a company ourselves, we are going through a tremendous growth phase and finding there's an awful lot of interest in our company at this point, in particular on the heels of our work with the Howard Dean campaign, which gives us a sense of perhaps an IPO may be a nearer-term possibility than perhaps initially expected. What I will say, however, is that I still believe that the bar for taking a company public is certainly higher than it was in the late 90s. You do need to be nearly profitable or profitable. You need to be of a certain scale as a business, which for us would suggest that we need to still knuckle down and continue with focusing on growing our business and think about an IPO as being probably at least a year out.
Vinay, you were at Harvard Business School, right?
I was, yeah.
Are you in touch with your graduating class, your colleagues from there?
Absolutely, yes.
What are you hearing from them in general? Is there a new sense of either optimism or even enthusiasm about what's happening in the investment sphere?
What I would say is that there is definitely a renewed sense of optimism, but I graduated from Harvard in 1998, and a great many of my friends within the next 12 months actually started companies like myself, primarily in the software industry and in the internet-related industry. Unfortunately, there are only probably two or three of us that are still standing. So we I think, as a class, have certainly been victims of the tough economic cycle and sort of hitting the internet market when it started to hit its downturn. But I think now we are starting to see a renewed sense of optimism, both as entrepreneurs prospectively as well as investors in the marketplace.
Vinay, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Vinay Bigat is founder and chairman of Convio in Austin, Texas. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our next call from Patrick, and Patrick's in Boston. Patrick, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually have a comment which perhaps leads to a question. I am founder of a young startup firm in the Boston area, and it's internet technology, so there's some similarities to the previous caller in terms of dealing with issues of scope and profitability when it comes to the size of the opportunity that venture cap firms will entertain.
What stage are you at now, Patrick?
We are operational, and we have our first group of customers, so I would say we're early stage. The technology is developed, and there are customers running on the platform. And just to kind of back up a bit, I've had success in the past. We lived through the boom, and I worked for a firm that developed e-commerce technology and was successful and then got bought right as the bubble burst, and so it closed down very quickly afterwards. So we were very cautious when we started this new venture to make sure that we had established technology and we had established customers and we were developing into a specific market.
Patrick, where's the money coming from? Is it coming from individuals or institutions at this point?
Right now it's been strictly privately funded from the founders and a handful of close friends and associates. And we've been talking to VC and angel firms for the last 5 months now to see if we can get this next round of startup capital to kind of get to the next level.
VC is venture capitalists, and what are they saying?
It's interesting. There seems to be a little bit of a double standard, and I think we're on the cusp of a transition in the psychology, like the gentleman from Common Angels is indicating. But we're definitely caught in the confluence of these two tides, in that we have an established product and we have a market, but when we go in front of these people, because of our conservative approach, the opportunity just isn't big enough. They want to see something that's going to go into the, you know, $10 to $50 million range, and we're saying, look, we want to build this slowly, and we want to be cautious about how big we're going to predict it's going to be.
This is kind of a flip from what we were hearing in the late 90s, Amy, when people with ideas were sort of like, we can do this and we can do this within a matter of weeks or months. Patrick's saying that running a company, building a company, demonstrating a little bit of a conservative attitude is, in fact, scaring people away. What's, from your perspective, why are people taking the attitude they are?
Well, it's also an interesting question about corporate strategy and funding strategy as you're building a company as an entrepreneur. We have started about 17 companies, and we've only taken 3 to venture capital financing. And those are the companies that we
felt... others have tanked, or they're still sort of puddling along at...
Right. There are many ways that you can fund a company that might be less expensive. You know, plenty of people fund stores or other companies with money from banks, or by building on revenue that the company creates. And they do these slow, people call it a bootstrap. They really grow the company without a major infusion of high risk and very expensive capital. So when we actually see a company, and it's very rare that we think could grow to be a $500 million or $1 billion company, then that really palpably feels like a venture capital kind of investment. One of the things that I've seen, I was actually speaking to some successful entrepreneurs in New Hampshire, is that the attitude of entrepreneurs has changed. In 1995, it was sort of the gold standard was to build a company and have it IPO. And now a lot of entrepreneurs are thinking, you know, I don't really want to necessarily bring a company to IPO. You have a lot of onerous reporting standards. It's very expensive to be a public company. There are a lot of shackles on public companies, and there are new regulations that, as you were saying, the Google founder has to make sure he doesn't go into prison, right? So you could have your company be acquired, or you could run that company as a successful and profitable business.
I want to turn to Ed here, because I think we need a little bit of of the professor in you there. We were listening to Patrick talk about his trials as an entrepreneur and Amy's analysis of what that means. When you take what you're hearing from Vinay and Patrick and Amy, how do you translate that to someone who's sitting at home and thinking, yeah, but am I supposed to invest in these companies or not? How do people make sense of what they're hearing here?
Well, I think that if you consider investing in these companies, then you consider investing at two very different stages. Either you consider investing as an angel, in which case you are, by definition, a high-risk individual with a lot of financial resources of which you feel comfortable in losing some significant portion of them and not worrying about it if the loss occurs.
Okay, so most of us are not going to be angels.
Okay,
what's the other choice?
So that's one group. Second group is you're interested in investing, but you see investing it as a public company. So you're investing in the high-tech sector or the particular firm or the industry, and you want to have that as part of your portfolio, just as you might instead have airline stocks or electric utility stocks or steel companies or something else. And the marketplace, you listen every day to the commentaries, they talk about things like enthusiasm for the tech sector, enthusiasm for the transportation sector. I never thought that way, so I don't even know how to relate to those people. But I guess from their big picture point of view, they see interest entering and disappearing. And to me, the tech sector, I guess, is speculative to a lot of people. I, frankly, don't really see that it's much more speculative than the automotive sector. Obviously, Daimler Chrysler Benz seems to have the capacity to have as large a downside or upside as some high-tech company does. But that's not seen as speculative. That's seen as a solid, real, whatever it is, company. So I think the thought process has to be one of self-assessment. You have to look at yourself and say, how speculative am I? And then I think you have to apply Amy's rules from before about how knowledgeable am I? I believe firmly you ought to do things with which you have some sense of familiarity. And if all of this is just a vague mystery, you're probably better off staying away from it all.
The worst of it, though, Amy, is that somebody, you know, grabs you by the shoulder at the office and says, voice over internet protocol, it's going through the roof. I can get you in for 500 bucks. You know what I mean?
Aren't there jokes about that, about, you know, bet on the horse in the fifth race?
That's, well, I'm glad similar. You put it in that perspective because we were all seduced last time around by all the stories of all the people who made all the money and thought, hey, they were or are no smarter than we are.
You know, I was lucky in a sense because I'm young enough that nobody could say I was an old fogey. And so I never went for the internet bubble. I had been speaking with Phyllis Yale from Bain & Company and was very concerned. I'm a young entrepreneur and I didn't get it. And Phyllis gave me very good advice. She said, stick to the fundamentals, Amy. You will not regret it. If you don't get it, don't do it.
The fundamentals, that's exactly what Ed was saying. Understand it or keep your money in your pocket.
Absolutely.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And talk this hour about what's happening in the high-tech sector. Some questions from people who have both eyes very carefully on what's going on in things that we barely understand, like biotechnology and nanotechnology and voice over internet protocol. What is that anyway? 1-800-423-8255. You mean I can call my mother for nothing? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And this is your opportunity to join our conversation about remortgaging our homes and putting it all into high-tech stocks that somebody we met on the bus said would be a particularly good investment. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's actually go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Philip's joining us on the line. Philip?
Hi, good morning.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Well, thanks for having discussions like this. I think that a company like Google will be very successful when they make their public offering, and because it's a matter of trust. I mean, when I go on my computer, I have the Google search engine on board, and I trust what they do. I think it's a wonderful company, and I think that based on that and that people see it and it works in their lives day to day, that there is an amount of trust and reputation that they have. But speaking of trust, unless and until there is a sea change in the way the stock market is regulated and until people like Ken Lay go to jail, I don't think the American public is going to trust the stock market or put their risky dollars into that.
It's a good point that you raise because it's hard, Philip, to talk just about what we're reading about, you know, possible boom in high tech if it's on the same page as some guy at Enron who's working out a plea bargain that's going to get him off early. And we're thinking to ourselves, is this really a place for me and my money, right?
Yeah, well, if you look at the damage that that Enron has done and the repercussions are being felt in California, and in India, and people see that. I mean, people are aware of that. I mean, it may be on the outside of their radar. I mean, everybody goes about their lives, but you know that, you know, nothing has fundamentally changed. And as I said, until that happens or people see that there is some integrity and honesty restored to the way the stock market's regulated, they're not going to trust it.
Now, people, Ed Roberts, that I know who are corporate lawyers would argue with Philip and say the rules have been changed. It's a lot tougher today than it was before. And I'm not sure whether or not that message is out to investors. What do you think?
I think the message may not be out to investors. It certainly is out to people who regard themselves as professionals in the field. I'm on four public boards. And believe me, the pain and suffering that board members have had during the past 2 years because of the Enrons and the Tycos and the like has been enormous.
You've got to put your signature on some financial report and put your own reputation and worth behind that signature, right?
And boy, does it cause people to worry a lot. And increasingly, people on public boards say, why in the world am I doing this? You don't get overly paid for doing it. It may be fun. It may be interesting. But you keep worrying, do I really trust, as a board member, do I trust the CEO and the CFO of this company that I'm on the board of to keep me out of trouble?
Well, quite frankly, I'm glad you're asking those questions. Yeah. And we should be, shouldn't we?
They have to be. And the laws and the regulations are now making it such that you increasingly have to ask larger and larger numbers of questions,
yeah,
with a lot more strict enforcement and the like. But I disagree with the premise of the caller. The premise of the caller was that people aren't getting back in, mm-hmm, to the market because of their unsatisfied, their justified bad feelings towards corporate activities. The facts are people are getting back into the market. I mean, the NASDAQ has gone from 1,300 in March to over 2,000 now, and that's an enormous increase. NASDAQ isn't a piece of imagination. It's people getting into the market and bidding up the prices of stock. So a lot of people have come back. I agree that some people have not come back. They're the ones still worried about it. I personally feel that most corporate executives are honest and that you do have the bad apples. The bad apples are the ones about whom lots of press gets devoted. I'll give you a very particular thing. What, besides Enron, you'll recall that at the same time, Tyco was very much in the news.
Most expensive shower curtain I ever heard about.
I was an initial director of Tyco Laboratories. That's almost 40 years ago. During three regimes of CEOs of Tyco that I knew about, I didn't detect any dishonesty whatsoever. Fortunately, I've been off the Tyco board for 20 years, so I don't have to worry about what's gone on with the more recent CEOs. But my point is that a particular individual at a particular point in time may end up blaspheming not only the company, but the industry,
sure,
and the whole entity, and it's unfortunate.
But, Amy, I want to get back to our callers, but psychology is important here. And what Philip sees in his morning paper about, yeah, maybe Google, and I trust Google, but the stock market and all I'm reading about and remembering is Enron. I mean, that has an effect on the way that people choose to spend their money, whether it's reasonable or rational or not.
Psychology is very important in the market. I am a very analytical person. And so I thought in the boom times, I thought the Dow was overvalued at 9,000 and it kept going up and up and up. That being said, I would really have one clear message for the listeners today, which is you really need to do your research before you buy a stock. Understand what you're buying and don't just buy a rumor on the market or somebody in the grocery store said, I heard voiceover technology is a good idea.
1-800-423-8255. And don't say you heard it here first. David from Durham, North Carolina, is joining us now on the line. Hi, David.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Talk about fundamentals. I was in Cisco and got creamed. And somebody who has 80% of the switching equipment, essentially, in that technology has got some really solid fundamentals. And I got creamed in the panic.
Right.
So what's the lesson then, David?
Well, the lesson was, as I was being a little greedy, I was sitting there, I had borrowed against my shares and taken advantage of a rise in the stock, which I had predicted, and I was right, and before I could clean it out, everybody panicked and took Cisco with it.
Before you could get it out.
That's exactly right, and I lost everything.
Can you tell me, then, what you're doing now? Are you investing again?
I'm living in my car. I only wish it was a joke.
If you had money, would you invest again? Are you thinking, you know?
I'd be really careful, but what I did wasn't wrong. It's just the panic. Everybody sat there and lost everything because of the panic. And I hadn't invested in a bubble company. I had invested very solidly, and I was really surprised. And I did learn that you don't put everything in there, but I was sitting there. I was greedy. I was taking everything and put it in there and waited for the right moment to get it because I said, they're going to find out about this real soon. You know, I had predicted that Cisco was acquiring something, and I said, this is going to cause a raise in the stock and when people figure out what it is. And I was right, and I got in on that, and I got in on the rise in the stock, and then the panic came along, and I was dead in the water.
Well, I'm glad you're calling us from North Carolina, because if you were calling us from Michigan, you'd be really cold.
It's cold today. It's down to the 20s. Frost on the inside of the car.
Try and stay warm, will you, David?
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. He did pay attention to the fundamentals, Ed. It's always going to be a gambling place, the stock market.
But listening to what he said, there's a fundamental that he didn't pay attention to, and that fundamental is you should never be investing what you can't afford to lose. And, you know, I made that comment earlier when I was talking about angel investors. Yeah. I think angel investors know that. They only put on the table what they're willing to part with because they understand it can all go away tomorrow.
Yeah.
Listening to these stories of people who were driven by greed and feeling that they could really make a great fortune, I guess we should apply the same rule to everybody. You should only put into the market that which you're prepared to fully lose tomorrow. Now, it's unlikely you will fully lose it, but that's the mentality that perhaps you really have to adopt. And you can't assume you're going to make the right brilliant decision and it's mm-hmm. going to take care of your retirement and what have you.
Ed, what about somebody who has a 401k or is buying a mutual fund for their retirement?
I would do it very carefully, and I would worry about portfolio balancing, and I would worry about getting advice and looking at a lot of things and periodically changing things, but being very sure that you're trying to balance your risks in a very careful fashion.
1-800-423-8255 to Burlington, Vermont now, and Art's with us. Hi, Art.
Hi, Art. This is Art, and it's minus 6 degrees Fahrenheit here.
You're not in your car then, are
no,
you?
No, I'm not.
Good thing.
But I just want to say, I may have missed this. I jumped in late today, but I mean, I was a co-founder of 4 high-tech companies, one of which IPO'd, and I think most technical people, the day that in the time the dot-com crash hit, we all cheered. We all thought it was a good thing because we were so frustrated at watching people not being able to distinguish between truly innovative new technology and hype in the marketplace.
Well, those of you who were cheering were the only ones left standing, or are you saying that the people who were sort of at the basis of this all and were looking at the sort of guts of it, as Amy was describing earlier, were the people who were happy to see that time pass?
Yeah, I think we were thinking two things. One, is there going to be any money left for us when we have real ideas that are really worth somebody investing in, because this is really going to change the world? And also just frustration of watching people who we thought were just, you know, making high-tech dog food and thinking, this isn't right.
Dogfood.com.
Yes.
Where are you now, Art? What's the picture as you see it now?
I'm a filmmaker now.
You're looking for money, right? I've never been a filmmaker who wasn't.
Perpetually, yeah. But actually, I sit on the boards of two companies. And, you know, another point here is that neither of these companies, you know, I've now had to change my life to think strategically from more tactically. And I think both of these companies, their exit strategy is to be acquired or taken over. There's no future in these companies IPOing. So we are building everything in planning for takeover.
Is that a good strategy, Amy, for companies to look at that as a way of making some money and getting out rather than going public, as Art's describing?
Well, I think one of the important things for listeners to understand is the sort of technology value chain for early stage companies. And I might turn this over to Ed, but one of the reasons a company might go for an initial public offering or for an acquisition is so that the founders and the early investors can get their money out.
Right.
And that's a very important thing to understand. I think, as I had been describing, a lot of entrepreneurs are shying away from the IPO strategy, as Art is seconding. But there's a lot that is important in terms of thinking strategically about how long and how long you're going to run your business as a standalone business, as opposed to selling it to a larger acquirer. Ed, what do you think?
Well, the data are that I published a book in 1991 called Entrepreneurs in High Technology, and it was based on 30 years of research then. The data at that point in time were that a much larger fraction of companies reach success by selling out to someone else than by going public. And I think that was changed during the period of the internet bubble, where it was dramatic that companies deemed to be successful went public. We're probably now back toward the earlier situation. You build a company, and unless you build a company to be spectacularly multi-billion dollar volume successful, probably the better disposition of the company is to become a division or a product line of a larger firm. So you try to, and those people are not going to buy on speculation.
So stand on the technological street corner and look sexy, and someone's going to come along and pick you up.
Well, you're not going to just look sexy. You better have real product, real sales, real profits, because they're going to look at you very, very carefully with teams of skilled people who will look at every part of your organization.
And that's a change from 3-4 years ago.
That's correct.
Ed, I want to thank you so much for coming in to be part of the program today.
Thank you.
Ed Roberts is chairman of the MIT Entrepreneurship Center. Amy Salzhauer, nice to have you with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Amy's founder and managing director of Ignition Ventures, a company that finds seed capital for the technology ventures. Earlier in the program, we talked with Vinay Bhagat. He is founder and chairman of Convio, a software company based in Austin, Texas. Our program is produced by Khalil Bird, Nancy Cohen, Catherine Fenelosa, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. Our news director is Sam Fleming. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.